Great. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to share some of this work. So what I'm going to talk about today is some generalizations of the idea of flux compactifications in string theory. Some of what I'm going to talk about, much of what I'm going to talk about, is described in a recent work at PH0508133 with Jesse Shelton, who is right there, and Brian Wecht, who is in Boston. He's a postdoc at MIT. So what I've prepared to do today is actually to really sort of cut this story down to the bare bones without a lot of complex details to try to really give you a flavor of what's going on here. I'm going to start with an introduction to flux compactifications, which is primarily aimed at those of you who are mathematicians or physicists who have been not working on the details of flux compactification. So I will elide some of the details and try to give a sort of the spirit of what's going on here from a mathematically comprehensible standpoint. Once I've sort of introduced that idea, I will talk about these new fluxes, which I will phrase non-geometric fluxes, which it seems may need to be taken into account when considering flux compactifications and may dramatically generalize the set of possible string compactifications you need to look at if you want to try to reproduce real-world physics. I will talk about what I mean by the word non-geometric. I mean, one could quibble about whether the things I'm talking about are non-geometric or more generalized geometries, and I'll just say what I mean by non-geometric as we go through the talk. And I'm certainly open to changing the words used to describe these things, but I think they're important independent of what words we use. Then I'll talk a little about the interpretation of these things.
I think we should call them wide spaces.
Well, Matai was talking about some similar things 2 weeks ago. And there they seem to have some sense of how these things can be brought into geometry, just as non-commutative geometrical spaces and spaces based on more general algebras sort of relate to geometry in a certain way. This, I think, fits into a similar paradigm. So we'll talk more about that. But you can call them whatever you want. And in addition to the interpretation, I'll talk about some constraints which these things have to satisfy, which I think give us a helpful perspective on how to understand these things. And then I'll talk about some further directions. I've already had quite a few stimulating discussions with people at this workshop, and that's helped to lead into some new directions in which one might take these things, and I'll talk a little bit about that at the end as time permits. So let me just start by giving a quick description of string compactifications where fluxes are included. Again, just really trying to distill this to the bare bones without getting into a lot of the technical details. So most of you are probably familiar with the idea that in string theory, we want to think about space-time as some 10-dimensional manifold, M10. And the standard picture is to think of this as some 6-dimensional manifold, which is compact, fibered over a 4-dimensional base. And in the simplest scenarios, when we have supersymmetry, this 6-dimensional manifold is a Calabi-Yau manifold. And in the simplest scenarios, we have a homogeneous space appearing in M4. This is either going to be flat-Minkowski space or anti-de Sitter space or de Sitter space with a cosmological constant, which is appropriately 0. Or negative or positive. Now, we want to describe the physics that we see in 4 dimensions when we take string theory in 10 dimensions and reduce it by getting rid of the extra degrees of freedom corresponding to fluctuations associated with either small oscillations on this small compact space or else strings that wind around it. And the language in which we often discuss that is to think about this from the point of view of supergravity. So string theory describes a complicated theory in 10 dimensions, which has a low energy limit, which is a supersymmetric analog of Einstein's theory of general relativity in 10 dimensions, and which is described by a 10-dimensional action, which is an integral root minus g. And I'll just write schematically what kinds of things appear in this action. I just write down some terms and then talk about them briefly. So this is sort of a schematic form of what you see in the 10-dimensional action. This R is the scalar curvature, just like in an Einstein theory of gravity. This should be e to the minus 2 phi multiplying these terms minus those terms. The e to the minus 2 phi, this phi here is a dilaton associated with the so-called string coupling. So this appears in string theory as 1 over g squared, where g is the string coupling. The phi here, there's a kinetic term for this. And then we have these things h squared and f squared, where h and f are higher dimensional form fluxes. So h mu nu lambda, which is essentially dB, is a three-form flux. So B is an antisymmetric two-form. H is the curvature of the antisymmetric two-form. More mathematically inclined, people would like to think of it as a gerb. Physicists generally tend to think of it locally just as some three-form. This is a three-form flux, and for string theory reasons, this is called the NSNS three-form flux because of the way that it arises in string theory. And then these Fs are P-form fluxes. Fp has indices mu 1 through mu p, and in general is the curvature of a p minus 1 form flux. So this is a p-form flux, which is called Ramond-Ramond, or RR, again, because of the way it arises when we quantize the string in these backgrounds. And there are two particular kinds of string theory and supergravity that I'm going to focus on, called 2A and 2B. And the difference from the point of view of this picture of between 2A and 2B is that in the 2A theory, we are allowed to have Ramond-Ramond form fluxes with P even. And in 2B, we have P odd. Okay. So if H and F, so H and F are some choice of forms on the full 10-dimensional space. If we choose H and F to be topologically trivial on X6, so if H and F have no interesting topological structure on the X6, then we can consider the zero modes, or the constant modes of the various fields. So there are various parameters associated with this compactification, which appear in the supergravity theory as the fields of this theory. So there are things, so there are zero modes, or so-called moduli. Zero modes of the dilaton of g mu nu, which I'll call the zero modes gamma mu nu, b mu nu, which I could call beta mu nu. So there are various zero modes of the fields appearing here. And in the case where H and F are topologically trivial, we reduce this to some potential. So we can take this full action here and just look at the evaluation of the action as we change these zero modes, which are essentially the things that parameterize the Calabi-Yau. So these are like the complex structure and scale parameters of the Calabi-Yau. We get a potential function, V4, which is a function of these various moduli. Okay. Now, if H and F are topologically trivial, there are supersymmetric solutions of the 10-dimensional gravity equations, where G10 factorizes into just flat space in 4 dimensions times a 6-dimensional Calabi-Yau metric. And the fields A and B are vanishing, and the dilaton is constant. So these are the traditional supersymmetric compactifications of string theory on a Calabi-Yau. The metric factorizes, the H field and F fields are trivial, and the potential here vanishes for any value of these zero modes. So what we have here is a bunch of so-called flat directions or parameters moduli for this compactification. What's that? Sure. Sorry, absolutely. dA and these are either harmonic or constant depending on what kind of manifold you're looking at. But the point is that dA and dB equals zero. So we choose these guys, and then the A's and B's will in fact be moduli. That's an important point. So the this contains moduli, as do A and B. And the dilaton, the string coupling itself, is a modulus of the compactification. Okay? So this gives us this problem of so-called flat directions in the physicist's language, or moduli in the mathematician's language. And now what we want to do is we want to include topologically non-trivial fluxes here in order to remove flat directions by making this potential function dependent on our moduli. Okay, so let's go over here. So we add fluxes. So now we say that H and F are not equal to zero topologically. And now what happens is this potential now gets contributions from these H squared and F squared terms. So now we get terms in the potential V, terms that would go like, for instance, H squared over the volume of the compactification squared e to the 2 phi. For example, if we turn on an H flux, we get a term in the potential that scales as H squared. And then you have to rescale the metric, basically, to make the Einstein term canonical to see what the overall power of the volume and the dilaton in this potential term are. But you can do the calculation and you get this. The point is that you get a dependence here on the dilaton and on the metric moduli once you put in the fluxes. Now, if this is all you do, you just put in fluxes like this, then you get a function which looks like this as a function of the compactification radius, where the potential just decreases as the compactification radius goes up, and this thing runs away to infinity. So you need to add some further physics in order to stabilize these moduli. If you just turn on the fluxes, things will in general run away. So to stabilize, you need one more bit of string physics. And the most popular and simplest way to stabilize these moduli has been to introduce something called an orientifold. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the string theory of an orientifold. An orientifold is some structure similar to a D-brain. With some important differences. It's got negative energy and no dynamics. So a D-brain, as most of you know, is some extended object of p dimensions that moves around in space-time. An orientifold is basically a fixed plane of a certain symmetry which acts simultaneously on space-time and on the string world sheet. And the effect of this from the point of view of the 10-dimensional theory is to see some fixed plane on which there's a negative energy concentrated. And by introducing these orientifolds, this potential can be changed so that it has a negative contribution and then runs off. If we, for instance, solve for the dilaton and then write this as a function of the radius, we can get a minimum which has a negative value of V at some finite value of the scale. So by introducing these features, first of all, fluxes, and second of all, this gadget called an orientifold, we can introduce a non-trivial potential on these moduli, which has the property that by choosing the fluxes and the other structure judiciously, we can stabilize the moduli. Okay. So this is the basic approach people have been using in string theory in a variety of contexts to stabilize the moduli. And this leads to candidate string vacua. So this enables us to now generate a large number of solutions of string theory, which correspond to four-dimensional physics with some set of fields and certain kinds of properties, which we can then compare to the real world. And so there's a big program going on in string theory, which is to try to, in all possible ways, choose Calabi-Yau manifolds, choose fluxes, compute these potentials, stabilize the potentials, and then look at the properties of those vacua. So this is something which people have been doing for a number of years now. Mike Douglas here has sort of systematized this and has been talking about ways of doing statistics on large families of these vacua. And there's been a fair amount of discussion at this conference and at this workshop and at other meetings recently about what one can do here. But the big problem that arises at this point is that there are really a lot of solutions here. So by a lot, well, first of all, I mean that we can certainly find an infinite number of solutions. So in a fairly recent...
I would just say a lot of potential solutions. Because
fair enough.
There are still unresolved issues, and for such an important claim,
absolutely
raise the bar a little. Obviously.
Absolutely. Okay, I could not agree with you more, Greg. Let me repeat what Greg said and emphasize it because I think it is important. So, by doing an analysis at the level of classical supergravity, we get this potential, and we can then make the assertion that this is a vacuum at the level of classical supergravity, assuming that the whole structure makes sense up to this point, including the orientifold. And now there's a lot of things which people do not understand in great detail. I've glossed over, as I said, many things. One of them is the fact that I've thrown away everything except the zero modes here. There are, of course, fluctuations which had to do with the structure on the Calabi-Yau manifold. This is called warping if it has a certain structure and has been, I guess, Steve Gittings talked about this a week or two ago and is studying various aspects of that. The warping or the dependence on the non-zero modes is very important, and when the compactification is not very large, this can completely change the physics. I've also neglected here an innumerable set of corrections. There are stringy corrections of all kinds. There are perturbative corrections, non-perturbative corrections. All these things must be brought under control in order to assert that you really have a well-defined vacuum. Now, that said, for example, in a paper last spring with DeWolf and Kotru and Giriovets, we found a set of 2A vacua which have a lot of nice properties. The string coupling, there's an infinite family of vacua. The string coupling runs off to zero. The volume of the compactification becomes large, so that it seems that things are very under control. But there are a lot of technical things which we don't understand perfectly. We don't even know what string theory is, so it's hard to be completely sure we know what we're talking about. But the indications are that there are a lot of potential solutions of this problem which could potentially lead to vacua of string theory. And this is potentially a problem. First of all, they're an infinite number, but then you can put in some simple cutoffs on things like the volume of the compactification, and then you're led to much more tractable numbers, which people estimate at things like 10 to the 500, which is still a sizable problem, even on a quantum computer. It's hard to see exactly how to sift through all these things and try to find the one that matches the real world. So somehow, we've got this big haystack, and we are optimistic that somewhere in there lies the real world, and it's a very exciting time because now we have a lot of interesting questions that we can try to address. How do we think about all these different vacua? As Greg says, are they really vacua? If they are, what does it mean that string theory produces all these different solutions, and perhaps many of these are realized in the real world. This has led to this multiverse, well, it's tied into the multiverse picture, which has been popular in cosmology for many years, in which the universe is much bigger than what we see. Different physics is realized in different areas. This gives a natural mechanism whereby in different parts of the universe, different string solutions would be relevant. And we would just happen to be living in this particular solution with the standard model. Wouldn't be totally coincidental because we wouldn't be there in certain other parts of the universe where the cosmological constant is much larger. But anyway, it leads to lots of interesting discussions. What I want to address in this talk is the following question. Are there lots and lots of vacua that we haven't even considered here? Right. So maybe this 10 to the 500 is actually just a really teeny piece of the full picture. So the question I want to address here is, are there in fact many more vacua which we should be worrying about and which we should have to take into account if we really want to claim that we're doing a comprehensive scan over all possible solutions of string theory? Sure. That we've always known that there are an infinite number of vacua in the sense that if you have a lot, you know, you can take an n equals 2 vacuification on a Calabi-Yau and there's an infinite family of them. That's a continuous parameter family. So the particular feature that we're looking at here is that we're trying to get rid of the massless field because we don't observe any of those in nature. We're also looking for vacua where, in principle, supersymmetry could be broken because we actually don't have supersymmetry in our universe. So, in fact, we're looking ultimately for solutions which don't have supersymmetry. Now, we don't really have the technical tools to address that problem in very much generality at this time. So what we're mostly doing is looking for isolated n equals 1 vacua or even isolated non-supersymmetric vacua. Mike and collaborators have done some work on non-supersymmetric vacua also, and lots of people have been thinking about those, but they're harder to get a handle on. The sort of standard thing that people in the field have been doing is looking at n equals 1 vacua where you can stabilize the moduli because it's a good starting point. It's not to say that our world has to be at one of those vacua, but we've already got lots of places to look there. So it's a place where we can start to get a handle on what we're doing. And what I'm going to suggest is that there are lots more, even with those special conditions placed on the vacuum. Although I think that there will also be lots in this new category which are not supersymmetric. Most of them will be extremely hard to calculate anything in, and that's interesting. Challenger. So the thing which, let me just draw a picture. So I mentioned that we have these two kinds of string theory, 2A and 2B. So 2B was the first class of vacua for which these flux compactifications with moduli stabilization with orientifolds was extensively studied. Work of Giddings, Kotcher, and Polchinski was one of the key things which got this going, and lots of papers since then have developed this. In general, the supersymmetric 2B vacua on a general Calabi-Yau have some features. They have vanishing cosmological constant in general, and if we fix all of the topological choices, the Calabi-Yau and various other things, there's going to be a finite number of different fluxes which satisfy certain constraints. So we have sort of one family of vacua which has certain properties coming from 2B. Now, we've been studying 2A more in recent years. Sorry, was there a question? Sure. Okay, this is at the classical level. That's right. Once you stabilize the Kähler moduli, so there's a whole extra story about what happens in 2B where you actually don't stabilize all the moduli generically in the classical supergravity picture. You have to look at non-perturbative effects, instantons and Gaugino condensation, which generically will both break the lambda equals zero and take you out of the classical regime. So they're classically at lambda equals zero, but there's still going to be a finite number in this category with a given set of topological choices. In 2A, on the other hand, if we look at supersymmetric vacua, we can find infinite families with lambda less than zero classically. With rather different properties than the 2B vacua. So we look at two different classes of vacua, and we find very different properties. Now, one of the things that Mike in particular emphasized early in these studies of lots of vacua is that one of the things we want to do is find a characteristic set of vacua, that is a big enough set of vacua that we can do statistics or study that set of vacua and really believe that we're getting a representative sampling of all the solutions of M theory or string theory. And these two sets of vacua don't seem to fit that criterion because they're so different. So what I'm going to suggest in this talk, basically.
I'm confused about this point.
Yes?
Is it really fair to compare the 2A as
I think you can certainly compare the numbers of them which appear.
But on the left number is also infinite because
no, but if you choose a Calabi-Yau and you choose an orientifold, there's a finite number.
You want to talk about the ones with the Kähler stabilized and lambda is zero, and there is a distinction that sort of says if the one is finite or some qualitatively different than the other.
Okay, do you want to add?
No, I couldn't say it precisely. I'm not the top of my head either.
Okay, let me just say it this way. We can definitely say that this set of vacua is different from this set of vacua. One of the ways in which you can see that very easily. What's that?
Different in the sense of not being mirror.
Not being mirror. That's right.
Obviously not mirror, so he's going to explain
it. They're obviously not mirror in the sense that if you look at this collection of vacua, they have physical properties which you cannot reproduce with a set of 2B vacua. Okay, and what I'm going to argue is that, okay, so the point is that we believe that type 2A and 2B string theory are related by a symmetry called mirror symmetry. So in fact, there should be some way of extending the class of vacua we're considering in either type 2A or 2B so that we get the same set of vacua from either point of view. And what I'm going to argue here is that if we include these things which I'm calling non-geometric fluxes, that in fact we get a much bigger picture where each of these is a special set of examples from a much larger class, which is manifestly mirror symmetric. So I'm not going to spend too much time arguing about how these things are different. We'll see it pretty well when we write down the next things I'm going to talk about, which is the low energy superpotential, which we use to distinguish these different things. Okay, that's kind of my introduction to flux compactifications. Let me just pause for a moment and take any questions on this general stuff before I start talking about what I want to add into the story. This is meant to be sort of a review of what people are doing and how people are thinking about it.
I'm so confused by saying that there's a finite number of them because you can actually remodel moduli, like volume, for instance, and just
keep
them
coming.
And
he meant to say it's stabilized.
Yeah, so once you take 2B on some particular T6, yeah, so there was a nice paper that Mike and Shamit and various collaborators wrote where they showed explicitly that although the Kähler moduli are not stabilized classically, there are non-perturbative effects which stabilize the Kähler moduli. Then, after you stabilize the Kähler moduli, for a given compactification, a given orientifold, T6 mod some discrete symmetry with a particular orientifold, that orientifold fixes a tadpole condition, and the number of fluxes which you can choose which satisfy that tadpole condition is finite once you mod out by all the appropriate modular symmetries.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I'm just asking, do you include non-perturbative effects?
Yeah, I think what you're trying to say is
that there are contradictions. You're saying lambda equals zero and
finite. Yeah,
lambda
is constant.
Okay. If you would like, I can remove the appending lambda. I think it's a good point that once I do want to include the non-perturbative effects because I want to look at the true string theory solution, right? Because what's classical on one side will not be classical on the other.
It's classical, we'll say KKLT vacuum. We granted the Kähler stabilization worked a certain way, and then the numbers are comparable. And this is sort of, you know, one way of doing it for each class of model. And there might be other ways to Kähler stabilize it that weren't counted there.
I mean, another way of thinking about it is if you take this class of 2A vacua, which we found, which is an infinite family, which are all physically distinct because they all have a different string coupling, there's no way to reproduce that over here. Right? These are all very much under control. You have complete control over perturbative, or you have a lot of control over perturbative and non-perturbative corrections because the string coupling has become so small. Yeah, so basically, I want to include all the physics here, and you're right that once you include all the physics, lambda will no longer be zero, so I won't try to compare those things. But I will try to compare the numbers of them. And there are other qualitative features that are just different. Anyway, I'm going to show a picture where I think this very naturally becomes unified. So I'm not going to spend too much time worrying about why they're different, because I think in this other picture they become very naturally related. Other questions? OK. So what do I want to do next? Now what I want to talk about is what we need to add so that we can see the same physics from both of these two points of view. And in order to talk about that, I need to introduce one more thing. So I want to talk now about the new non-geometric fluxes. So in a supersymmetric, in a supergravity theory in four dimensions, so we believe that you take the supergravity theory in 10 dimensions, you compactify on your Calabi-Yau, and in four dimensions you have another supergravity theory. In four-dimensional supergravity theories, there's a convenient way to express the potential, the so-called scalar potential, in terms of some more fundamental object which appears in the supersymmetric formalism. That's something called the superpotential. It's basically sort of a linearization, if you will, of this, of these equations here. So we can rewrite V as e to the k, just schematically dw bar minus 3w squared, where w is called the superpotential, and k is the Kähler potential. So these are just functions. Dw here is just partial of w plus dk times w, and there's some appropriate holomorphic and anti-holomorphic indices which are contracted with the Kähler metric. You don't really need to know that. The important thing I'm going to tell you about is that this potential, which remember was quadratic in the fluxes, can be rewritten as a something which is quadratic in a thing called w, which is linear in the fluxes. And so far by fluxes, I mean the Fs and the Hs. Okay, and there are a bunch of subtleties which I'm not going to get into. Some of you may be familiar with a particular example of this, which is the famous Gukov-Vafa-Witten superpotential, which is just the integral in 2B on a Calabi-Yau of G wedge omega, where omega is the holomorphic 3 form, and here G is just F minus a complex axiodilaton times H. So basically, the linear dependence of W is explicitly given here, where we have an integral over the six-dimensional manifold of a three-form wedge, the holomorphic three-form. Okay. Now, what I want to do now is go through a very specific example and see how the physics that we see in four dimensions is very different in the 2A and 2B story. Then we'll see what we can do about that. So I'm just going to look at the simplest case, which is the torus. And so all we need to know up to this point is that this superpotential is the important thing in encoding the low-energy four-dimensional physics. So I'm going to look at an example, T6, which I'm going to restrict attention to T6s, which are just three copies of the torus. So I'm just going to take three identical tori, and there are other moduli, and I can turn those off either by imposing fluxes, which have certain symmetries, or by imposing discrete symmetries. We could have more discussion about that if people want. But I'm basically just going to assume that this is three copies of a torus with the same scale and complex structure parameter. And I'm going to look at this in 2A or 2B. Okay. Now, what are the moduli of this compactification? So there's one modulus, which is tau. In the 2B theory, this is just the complex structure modulus of this torus. There's one which I'll call S, which is the axiodilaton. And there's a modulus U, which is the Kähler modulus, which includes, in addition to an axion, it also has the scale of this torus. So the scale of the torus fits in the Kähler modulus, and the complex structure of the torus fits in tau. We can do the same thing in 2A, and S is still the axiodilaton, but tau and U reverse roles. And I'll be a little more explicit about this in a minute or two. Basically, on the torus, we can use T-duality, which I'll talk more explicitly about in a few minutes, to take one torus to another torus. I'm going to do one T-duality on each T2, And that one T duality on each T2 will switch the complex structure in Kähler modulus. This is the analog of mirror symmetry for T6. Okay? Now, let's write down this superpotential for this very simple model. So this is actually very easy to do. For 2B, for example, we can just read it directly off of this formula right here by just writing down the complex structure, writing down the holomorphic 3 form, dz1, wedge dz2, wedge dz3. And we can immediately read off that. So let's write down what we know. W2B. I'll just write it down schematically. There's some f, some component of f, plus another component of f times tau, plus another component of f times tau squared, plus another component of f times tau cubed. I'll put some indices in some of these things eventually, but I'm not going to write all the indices for the starters. Then there are some terms which depend on S. This is the thing I called capital phi here. It's the axial dilaton. So again, that was what I just wrote down is the terms that come from the capital F wedge omega. And then we have the S times H. So that gives us some other terms where we have some H plus H tau plus H tau squared plus H tau cubed. Okay? So that is the precise superpotential for the toroidal compactification as written in the 2B theory. Okay? Now, what if we do the same thing in 2A? So in 2A, the story is a little bit more complicated. There was some nice work of Grimm and Louis that went through in really complete detail how to do the analogous compactification and compute the superpotential in that case. If we do the compactification in 2A, we get the following. We again get some terms with Fs in them. Now in 2A, of course, we have different Fs, but I, again, won't be writing the indices on the Fs for the moment. I'm not sure I'll write those down. We get something like this, where the Fs are, again, Ramond-Ramond fluxes. And then we find the following. We find that there's an H appearing with a term linear in S, and a U appearing with a term linear in an H with a term linear in S, sorry, in U. So the superpotentials for these two things are quite different. We have a set of parameters which appear in the same way in the superpotentials, and those are the Ramond-Ramond fluxes. Okay. However, the other terms in the potential seem to be rather different. They all depend on the H flux, but they appear in different ways. So let's be a little bit more explicit about the T duality, which we expect to relate these two pictures. Okay, so we expect that there should be a T duality which relates 2B to 2A. And now I have to be a little more explicit about these orientifolds. In 2B, we are assuming that we have an orientifold 3-plane, so an orientifold plane which fills space and does not extend in any directions on the torus. When we T-dualize that 3 times, let's say in dimensions which we'll call alpha, beta, and gamma, it gives an O6. And in fact, the formula I wrote down here assumes an O6 plane. And now let's look at how the index structure of these things works. Well, we'll say more about this in a minute. The Fs, it turns out, you can check, are explicitly T-dual. That is, you can write down the index structure on the Fs appearing here, these Ramond-Ramond fluxes, and their T-duals are precisely the things you would expect in the appropriate places in the superpotential. How about H? So we have three directions, alpha, beta, and gamma, which are the directions that the O6 is extended in. There's three other directions, and let's call them I, J, and K just for labeling purposes. The indices on this guy here are H, I, J, K. This is the only position in the superpotential where we have a coefficient in both cases given by a certain flux. And in this case, we get the same coefficient. And in fact, this is a flux which is unchanged by T-duality. And I'll say a little bit more about this just in a moment. Let's just get into that. So let me be more explicit about what T-duality does to various fluxes. So how does T-duality act on RR fluxes? Well, this is something physicists have studied for a long time. We know that if you have RR flux in dimensions A1, A2 through AN, and we do a T-duality in direction, say, A1, this then becomes the flux in directions A2, dot, 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 AN. By the way, I should emphasize that starting a little while ago, whenever I write H or F, I really mean the topological equivalence class of H or F. It's really an element of cohomology, and I don't mean the field, which is taking values at different places in the compact manifold. I just mean so in a sense, these are integrated fluxes. We might put a bar over them to indicate that they're integrated over the appropriate cycles, but I'll just leave it at that. Anyway, the rules for T-duality on Ramon-Ramon fluxes are very simple. T-duality in a certain direction either removes or adds the relevant index from the appropriate Ramon-Ramon flux. And if you use those rules, I won't write down all the indices, these guys precisely, these are all three forms here, and the appropriate T-duals give you the appropriate 0, 2, 4, and 6 form Ramon-Ramon curvatures there. Now, what we need to be able to do now is to do something similar for the H's. If we want to say that this superpotential is T-dual to this superpotential, we need to have a set of rules for doing T-duality on these H fluxes. So this is very closely related to what Matai was speaking of the week before last, the problem of doing T-duality on H fluxes. If we want to assert that these superpotentials will be the same, because we believe that mirror symmetry should allow us to represent any vacuum that we see in 2B as a vacuum in 2A, then we have to find things which fit in these slots here and in this slot here to fill out these superpotentials so that we have a T-duality invariant picture. Well, the fact that this part here maps independent of the fluxes. So here we can do T-duality on the Fs, and we get this part of the superpotential to work out perfectly. And this piece works out perfectly. Gives me some optimism that the T-duality rules on the fluxes are not going to depend on what your moduli are. Okay. So let's follow this and see where it leads us. And then we can talk about it. That'll be the interpretation part. So what I want to do now is basically say, okay.
This is also assuming that T-duality for mirror symmetry extends to n equals 1 vacuum.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's not a spherical sum.
Yeah, so I could give some argument for that based on, if you imagine that there exists a string field theory, which is somehow formulated in the language of type 2 string theory, if you do string field theory or any non-perturbative approach to string theory, there's some non-perturbative language in which you can express a kind of tunneling from a background without some particular H flux to a background which has that particular H flux. That process should be something you can describe either in the 2B or 2A language.
But it could be that the configuration spaces were very different in B and 2A, yet the set of stable points were the same.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is if you have one point which can be identified between the two theories, I think, let me say it slightly differently. Imagine there's one point which, one solution which we really agree is the same, it can be viewed either from 2A or 2B. And we believe, for instance, that the torus with no background fluxes should certainly be something we can understand both in 2A and in 2B, right? Then let's say I'm using 2A coordinates and you're using 2B coordinates, right? And then I do something in 2A. I do some non-perturbative thing to turn on an H. I'm saying that you should have some language to express that process. And you would call it some kind of flux. Now, it may not look like something you're familiar with. In fact, I'll argue that these things don't look like things that we're familiar with. But you should have some language for expressing that. And the reason I'll come back to this later, but the reason I think it's important to do this is because I think you can have backgrounds where neither observer will see it as a completely standard background. Right? I mean, it's certainly the case that there are backgrounds which are visible both from 2A and 2B as standard backgrounds of string theory. And I guess all I'm arguing is that in using the language of 2A to describe some physics, I want to extend the language of 2A to include physics where we've turned on these things here. And then I'm just going to ask, what would we call it in 2A if we turned on one of these things here? Maybe another way of addressing your question, Greg, is that this is not a transformation. This is really two representations of the same physics, is the way I would like to think about this. It's not a duality transformation which is going to transform this W according to some complicated transformation law. This is really just two different ways of labeling the same physics. Right, if we're in a particular T6 background with just some F, say, turned on and say some time dependent thing where it's running off to infinity. That's a single string background, and I would label it one way and you would label it the other way. And this is really just a coordinate transformation telling me how my coordinates differ from your coordinates.
But then one graphic function, like the entry on the
manifold, yes.
And the derived from
RDL. Yes.
And then there should be equivalent description from type ray frame.
Yes.
It's probably very complicated and transient uncertainty. So why is it so different from
it? Well, because in this case, I'm going to argue that there's some statements we can make which actually make sense and where we can actually begin to get a grasp on this. And the second reason is I think we have to deal with this because I think there are backgrounds, in fact, possibly most string backgrounds, which we would not see either from this picture or from this picture. Okay? Let me just continue a little further. And I'm actually going
to
put in... Yeah, that's another good answer.
Yes. If you're talking about an isolated vacuum, there can only be one supergravity subscription, which is good at any time. You're really pushing the other one beyond its region of validity, and there's not something.
Absolutely. But I'm worried about cases where neither one will have a good supergravity solution, but there will still be a controlled approximation. In other words, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but just to try to address your question. Let's say I chose a vacuum that was really a 2B vacuum, and I tried to describe it in 2A languages. I'm going to put some other things down here, which are these so-called non-geometric fluxes. I would say, okay, this is something with these non-geometric fluxes turned on. And you would say, well, why do you use this Baroque language to describe this thing when you should have been using the 2B language? And it's certainly the case that there will be cases where that 2B picture is the only picture in which you have a good supergravity picture. But there are cases where you have these things turned on, and the physics is still under control. And it's under control because there's a parametric separation between the scale of the Kaluza-Klein modes and the winding modes or whatever else is appearing in here and the low energy modes. And that dependence is not unique. It's not obvious to me that that can only occur when there is a 2B dual. In other words, there may be backgrounds where you turn on some complicated combination of these things. You still have a vacuum which is under control. And yet there's no dual picture in which it has this standard geometrical picture in terms of supergravity. That's what I'm concerned about. And that's why I think we have to understand these things better, because if we can't rule that out, then we're running the risk that all but a set of measure zero of the string vacuum are out of our range. So I think we have to understand what we can say about these things. So this is just we're groping forward here to try to understand, are these things that we should make sense, that we can make sense of, that we want to take seriously? And the indications to me, at least so far, are that yes, there's enough structure in here that actually we can do calculations with these things, we can start to take them seriously, and maybe think of them as an expansion of our set of string vacua. So let me go a little bit further and then come back to this in the interpretational issue. Okay, so what I want to then essentially, one can sum up what we want to then do in the following sense. We have a set of T-duality rules for RR fluxes. I want to now propose a set of analogous T-duality rules for NSNS fluxes. Okay, we're going to start with an H ABC, and we'll see that part of this actually starts to make sense. So I will spin some web here and then argue that at least the first steps in that path are actually completely sensible. So we have some H ABC. If we do T-duality on A, let's just label the thing we get as some new quantum numbers. So these are integers, labeled by an F where we've removed one lower index, but I'm going to keep it around because we might need it, so I'll put it upper. Okay? Yes?
I've been confused for a while, but I think I kept thinking, why don't you just use the Boucher rules for figuring out...
I will. I'll come back to that. What will happen is we can actually use the Boucher rules to move partway along this, and then it'll break down. So keep that in mind for 5 more minutes. Okay, because actually that's exactly what we're going to do. But the point is that this will carry us beyond where we can go with the Boucher rules. For instance, the analog of the Boucher rules, if you think of the Boucher rules as acting on A's rather than F's, the Boucher rules will take you all the way to F1, but Boucher will not take you to F0, because F0 is not the derivative of any A field. So you would never know about massive 2A if you just did Boucher rules. Okay? So I'll come back to that in just 3 minutes, 5 minutes or something, or 10 minutes. 5 minutes. okay.
Today.
Yes. very shortly. So let's now just, this is just going to be essentially a labeling. We're going to say, okay, the way we label the T-dual of an HABC in the A direction is FABC. If we do another T-duality in the B direction, we'll label that QABC. And if we do another T-duality, TC, we'll label that RABC. And we'll see where they fit in there, and then we'll worry about what the heck these things are. Okay? So if we just make that assumption, we can take what we know here, and we can start to stick in, let's see where I want to go here. Okay, so what we know here, this is going to be alpha JK, this is alpha beta K, this is alpha beta gamma, and this is alpha beta K, where again, alpha and beta in the 2A language are special indices associated with directions extended along the orientifold 6 plane. So the directions we're T-dualizing in are alpha, beta, and gamma. So here we had an H going to an H, so there's no T-duality. Here we have an H going to an F, so we expect that the T-dual of this is going to be F alpha JK ta or we could have lifted one of the J's, but let me not write down all the possibilities. This is going to be some Q alpha beta K. This is going to be R alpha beta K. This thing down here, we had an H extended an alpha beta K. We T-dualize an alpha beta gamma. That means that there should be a term here, U with a Q alpha beta K, alpha beta lower K. Okay? Now, I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but we can now proceed step by step using some sequence of arguments to show that, in fact, this is still not going to be quite enough, because now this theory here in 2B, these Qs here, this Q has an alpha beta K, but there's nothing special about the alpha beta directions in the 2B theory. The orientifold plane doesn't extend in any directions. So we can just use rotations in this theory to show that actually we have a whole set of other terms here. So just by using rotational invariance, we get a whole new cubic polynomial with coefficients in Q down here. And then we can T-dualize that back, and we get some Fs here, and some Qs here, and some Rs here. Okay, so by using a combination of this ansatz for what we call the T-duals of these things and rotational invariance, we generate superpotentials that look like this, where now we can interpret this as two different languages for a common set of vacua. These are two T-dual descriptions of the same set of low-energy theories described by some particular superpotential. So that at this point, my claim is that the complete set of type 2 toroidal compactifications with general fluxes should be described as a cubic polynomial in tau plus s times a second cubic polynomial in tau plus u times a third cubic polynomial in tau. Okay? And let me now just jump straight into interpretation and what these things would mean if they're really there, since I only have about 5 minutes. No, well, let me. So parts of this you can understand perhaps from the world sheet point of view, but not all. Let me. You go back to what Gary was asking about the Lucia rules and how far we can get with that, and then maybe come back to the question you were just asking. So far, what I've basically been the point of view I've been taking here is there are things you can do in 2B. Imagine you had a name for those things in 2A. All I've done here really is given a name in type 2A to something we know we can do in 2B, and given a name in 2B for something we know we can do in 2A. Now the question is, does this make sense? Is there any sense in which we should really think about these as additional things we could add into the theory? And so from that point of view, what I want to now do is argue that yes, we should. So let me now discuss how much of this we can really understand. So this, again, is very closely related to what Matthias spoke about 2 weeks ago. So let me go on to interpretation, and I'll maybe say a couple things about constraints. Okay. So again, this is precisely the same kind of thing that Matthias spoke about. And in the language of his talk, F would have been twisted tori, Heisenberg manifolds. Q, he was describing in the language, if you do this from the point of view of K-theory, in his talk he argued that you can show what the algebra of whose K-theory, the appropriate K-theory, is appearing, and this gives you a field of non-commutative tori in the Q case, and he argued that the R's would correspond to non-associative tori. And I won't add anything to what he said. He has a very nice mathematical way of understanding this, and I would like to understand better how that ties into another approach, which I'll now describe, which is basically just to try to interpret these, as Gary suggested, using the Boucher rules. So what if we just naively move ahead and try to use the Boucher rules to see what happens if we T-dualize H-flux? Let's see how far we can get. So we start out with an H. Say HXYZ equals N. We can represent that by a BXY, which is NZ. So we just choose a spatially dependent B field with a constant curvature. Now let's just T-dualize that in the X direction. Okay? That's supposed to give us what we call FXYZ. If we perform the Boucher rules, we get a metric. So the B field vanishes, and we get a metric which looks like ds squared equals dx plus fxyz zdy squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. This is called the twisted torus.
You're not worried when the centric is on the solution of equations of motion?
It is the solution of the equations of motion when you include the fluxes as sources. Okay, good. Sorry. Okay. Here, okay, there's an issue here, which is, am I only considering how this works if we look at solutions of the equations of motion, or am I extending consideration to things which are not solutions of the equations of motion? I can give you three answers to that. One answer is that there are solutions, as I mentioned earlier, which have H-flux and F-flux turned on, which are good solutions of the equations of motion. These are the flux compactifications. They're more complicated for various reasons. In particular, because they have Ramon-Ramon fluxes, we don't have a perturbative description in the world sheet. So we run into problems in the string theory interpretation because we don't know how to do string theory in Ramon-Ramon backgrounds. I don't think anybody believes that string theory doesn't make sense in Ramon-Ramon backgrounds. We just don't have a world sheet description. Second answer is, we can always make these things time dependent. So I showed that, you know, if you turn on an H-flux, it runs off to infinity. We could put in that time dependence. Then you can have a good background where you have an H-flux, and the thing runs away to infinity over time. That's a good solution of the equations of motion. Okay. And the third thing I could say is, I don't really care whether the solutions of the equations of motion, because I believe that this should all work anyway. Yeah, it could take something non-zero to something non-zero. I said, Greg, at this point I should ask, how much longer should I keep going for? Okay, I won't go to 12:30, but I will keep going for a while. I'll aim at 12:15. People should feel free to leave if they're hungry or whatever. Okay, so if we do T-duality here, using the Boucher rules, we get the so-called twisted torus. This is a fine metric. If the original thing solved the equations of motion, then the T-dual thing will also solve the equations of motion. Right? We could have a time dependence where the thing is expanding. The same thing happens here. If we had a flux compactification, which was a good supergravity solution, the T-dual of that will still be a flux compactification, which is a good supergravity solution. I think we would all agree that this is a nice, well-defined manifold. Note that as z goes to z plus 1, something special happens in each case. Here, b goes to b plus n in this case. If we take z goes to z plus 1, we just add n to b. Here, if we take z goes to z plus 1, x goes to x minus ny. That's why it's called the twisted torus. This is a metric on an object which looks like a torus, but when you identify the bottom to the top, the bottom here is identified with a skewed version at the top. This picture is for n equals 1. Okay, and this is actually precisely the Heisenberg manifold that Matai spoke of 2 weeks ago. One can I'll say a little bit more at the end about this. You can generalize this and even do mirror symmetry here, and you end up with something called a half-flat manifold. And this story all seems to make sense, although there are still some details to be worked out. But already at this point, if you're inclined to worry about whether this sort of T-duality is valid, you might worry right here. Okay, Greg's not worried yet, so that's fine. Okay, great. So we're very happy with this. And in fact, so now we have two terms here which have these Fs in them. And in fact, these terms, I told this story a little bit historically out of order, because these terms were in fact written down by Villadoro and Sferner and Camarafont and Ibanez by including these things as what are called geometric fluxes. That is, as objects which twist the metric in this way. And these are things which people have studied for many years, these twisted tori. They're an example of Schirk-Schwarz compactifications. And people have done lots of analyses of these. Again, these guys found that precisely these Fs, which here, the way I presented it, we derived them just by making a statement about how we interpreted the duals of H fluxes. But these things actually arise at this place in the superpotential. OK, so now let's carry on and go one step further with the Boucher rules.
But we no longer have a single manifold on which we're turning on form. We have a whole collection of manifolds.
Absolutely. So there's something very deep going on here, which I don't understand.
What does it mean to write them all in one formula for superpotential?
Absolutely. So, OK, there's two questions in what you just said. And let me separate them slightly. If I'm going to keep going until 12:15, I will address this briefly. I'll push part of it to the end. One issue is what you just said is that we no longer have a single manifold with some flux. Now we have a collection of manifolds where somehow we're thinking of this as a Calabi-Yau. I mean, in some moral sense, I'm thinking of this as a Calabi-Yau plus some fluxes. But some of those fluxes are taking us away from the Calabi-Yau geometry and into something else. And this is the paradox, if you will, that was sort of first addressed in this paper of Louis Guerrieri, Miku, Louis and Waldron, where they looked at mirror symmetry of this kind of thing, where you have one, I'll talk more about mirror symmetry at the end, where you have one leg of the H-flux on the T3 for a Sturm and Dryau-Zaslow, where essentially what they were speculating is that somehow there's a class of manifolds, these half-flats, whose moduli space is in some sense morally the same as that of the associated Calabi-Yau for each choice of these half-flats. But you're no longer looking at a single manifold. So somehow, in some moral sense, there's a whole space of things which are all indexed by the moduli space on a certain Calabi-Yau and some integral choices of fluxes. But they're no longer all geometrically associated with that Calabi-Yau. So in some sense, we're already moving away from the explicit Calabi-Yau geometry here when we turn on this flux. So we already need to grab. So I think this is actually a very important case to understand better, because in grappling with this case, we may make progress in a general set of tools we can use in the more general non-geometric case, where essentially the same structure appears. You have a Calabi-Yau, and you have something you're calling a flux, but it takes you away from that Calabi-Yau. Right? But here, your point is excellent, that we're already doing that here. We're already taking us away from the Calabi-Yau by putting in these fluxes. Now, you also said, what sense does it make to talk about these as superpotentials? And there's a very valid question here, which nobody's yet asked, but I'll just point it out. And that is, when you speak of this superpotential, you've thrown out a bunch of degrees of freedom. You've thrown out all the winding modes and the momentum modes and things like that. In what sense is this a good low-energy approximation? Or does this describe the superpotential of a theory which is a good low-energy approximation? And that is not clear in these cases. I would also argue that it is not clear in general influx compactifications. Because in general influx compactifications, when you turn on these fluxes, what degrees of freedom are light and what degrees of freedom are heavy can move around. And if your compactification is string scale and everything gets mixed up, this might not be a good approximation. What you need to do is, this is a good tool for finding solutions, and then you can check the solutions to see if they're good approximations. So I mentioned this class of 2A vacua we looked at, where we took this superpotential in 2A, we extremized it, we found a bunch of solutions, and then we showed that they were not corrected very heavily because the string coupling is small and all these things. In principle, you would have to do a similar thing for any of these other vacua. So my answer to your second part of your question would be, this is a good approximation when you can solve it and then show that the corrections are small.
Joe did ask that question, in the guise of saying that we don't really accept the dual descriptions of the
panel. Absolutely. And what I'm worried about here is that there may exist solutions where we turn on these Fs and Qs and Rs, where there's no dual description in which it's just geometric and a standard Calabi-Yau, but nonetheless, it may still be under control. Because we know there are examples where you turn on the Qs, where it's actually under control, and you can't tell very easily that it's under control from the point of view of the theory where it's got a Q description. Those are the ones which have a dual geometric description. Right? So we know that that can happen. I'm not saying we've proven that it is the case. We're searching right now for solutions which have this disturbing property that they're under control and yet not geometric in any duality frame. We haven't found those yet. But that's the point is, I want to make is I think it's an important direction of inquiry to ask whether there are solutions which are not geometric in any duality frame. Because if we find those, we need to worry about this much more extensively than we have so far.
There is also a lecture that even before stabilizing moduli, we don't even know how many moduli we have.
Absolutely. And absolutely. So certainly I think on half-flat manifolds, I mean, this is why I think that the one of the best ways to make progress on all this is to start by understanding these half-flat manifolds better, because those are certainly decent manifolds, and we don't really understand how to handle them. They seem to be related in some fundamental way with Calabi-Yau through this kind of duality. And I think understanding that connection better might give us some tools for understanding them. But certainly, I don't think anybody would argue that there shouldn't be any string compactifications on half-flat manifolds because we generated them in this way. Okay, let's continue answering Gary's question and do one more T-duality here. So this, we can now do a T-duality using the Boucher rules in the Y direction. Wait. I knew Greg was going to stop me here. Okay, imagine that we did not include this periodicity condition, if we looked at the covering space. So if we consider Z to be in the real line, there's a covering space on which this is still a good solution. So on the covering space, this is a fine solution, this is a fine solution, and we can still use the Boucher rules to do T-duality. Okay? So on the covering space, we do T-duality, and now this is supposed to be something described by Q, X, Y, Z, and we can explicitly get that B, X, Y is equal to NZ over 1 plus N squared Z squared, and DS squared is equal to 1 over 1 plus N squared Z squared times dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And now, still thinking on the covering space, we can ask, what is the periodicity condition that seems to happen as z goes to z plus 1? And what happens is that if we write rho as b plus I times the volume, then 1 over rho goes to 1 over rho plus n. Okay? So If we don't do the compactification, I claim that everything is absolutely kosher up to this point, and we have a fine T-dual, and we have a certain kind of string vacuum, if we have chosen one to start with, which is a vacuum. And it's got this odd periodicity condition, where the periodicity condition is not expressed by a diffeomorphism or by any kind of topological map on the space-time. This map is intrinsically not a geometric map because it includes this inversion. It's essentially doing a T-duality, adding one to the B field, and then doing a T-duality back. And that means that if we now ask, can we just quotient out by this symmetry, we can do that, I believe, but we will not get a geometrical compactification of string theory. So I think it makes sense to do this compactification, but people will ask, and Greg in particular is poised to ask, can you make sense of this from the point of view of the string world sheet? And my answer to this is no, not at this stage. We don't know how to do this from the point of view of the string world sheet. But we know from the point of view of the gravity theory, this is just a T-duality, which is a fine symmetry, we should be able to do an orbifold of the covering space theory. So we do a solution on the space without imposing the z goes to z plus 1 condition. This has a symmetry. We can quotient out by that symmetry. And this gives us some kind of a non-geometrical compactification. And that is what I would say we would get for the meaning of these Qs if we try to interpret them using the Boucher rules. So the answer to Gary's question is, if we try to use the Boucher rules, this is what we get. And it's a little bit funny because it's something we're not totally accustomed to. Now, this is something people have talked about. So Chris Hull has talked about things called T-folds. And Brian Wecht and collaborators, and even earlier, McGreevy, Flournoy, Williams, and McGreevy, Flournoy, and Brookie Williams looked at these kinds of objects. And in fact, what we're finding are objects which look just like this. They have this structure where you have a base loop and you go around it and you mod out by some more general u-duality or t-duality symmetry than just a diffeomorphism kind of symmetry. So from the point of view of the Boucher rules, I would assert that the Q's have a natural interpretation, but it's in terms of this kind of locally geometric but globally non-geometric point of view. Now let me just compare. So Matai spoke of the S as twisted tori, and let me now, what do we get from the point of view of the Boucher rules? We also get the twisted tori. The field of non-commutative tori in our case is a locally geometric, globally non-geometric string compactification. And the R's now are even worse because the Boucher rules are completely unable to deal with this thing, which has a heavy Z dependence, just as the analog of the Boucher rules for Ramon-Ramon fluxes cannot generate a zero-form flux. So these things seem to be intrinsically non-geometric. Another way of seeing this is that if you look at what might be the space of zero brains on one of these spaces, they have different kinds of properties. If you take a zero brain on a twisted torus and you move it around, it comes back as a zero brain. If you move it around, the Z goes to Z plus 1. If you take a zero brain on one of these puppies here and move it around, when it comes back, the zero brain becomes a zero brain plus a 2 brain. So your identification of what you think of as a point on the space changes as you go around it. That's another way in which I would say it's globally non-geometric, because a zero brain defining a point is not globally well defined. What if you try to define points on something with an R? Well, the triple T dual of that is defining a D3 brain on a 3 torus or a manifold with H flux. And you can't put a 3 brain on a manifold with H flux. So there are no D0 brains living on this thing here. That's another piece of evidence that if this thing makes sense in string theory, it's going to be intrinsically non-geometric, not even locally geometric like these guys are. Okay, I'm even approaching my self-imposed 12:15 cutoff, so let me just try to put it all in 5 more minutes here and make a few more comments and then talk about where this is going. Okay, so what we've found then is that it seems to be that in order to think of the set of type 2 compactifications as being really mirror symmetry or t-duality invariant, we have to propose the existence of a new class of flux-like integers characterizing features which, as Dave pointed out, will take us away from the particular Calabi-Yau, but somehow may give us a meaningful construction. If we just impose the little f's, we get some half-flat or twisted torus, which we know we can make sense of. If we impose the q's, we get something which we're still grappling with. It's a field of non-commutative tori or some t-fold, locally geometric, globally non-geometric thing. If we turn on the r's, we're really unclear as to what we're talking about, but it seems that they need to be there in order to make this picture match. If we believe that all this makes sense, we can then go ahead and compute some constraints which these fluxes have to satisfy. So we know that there are certain constraints which the existing pieces, like the f's and the h's, have to satisfy. For instance, there's a constraint d plus h acting on f equals 0. If we just impose the condition that that extends to something which is invariant under t-duality, this becomes a new condition which looks more, which has sort of an h times f plus a little f times f with an index contracted plus a q with two indices contracted with an f plus an r, f with three indices contracted. If you want the details, you can look at our paper for the exact formula for this constraint. So there's a set of constraints where these things have to equal 0. And if you choose fluxes which don't satisfy this, there's presumably not any meaning to that kind of construction. So somehow there's a well-defined constraint on these things. There's a second set of constraints which are more complicated. These are sort of Ramon-Ramon constraints, if you will. And then there's an analogous set of NSNS constraints, which has sort of h dot f equals 0, or f dot f plus h dot q equals 0. There's various other constraints. If you just restrict to the case of twisted tori, this is, again, something you can see and is known in the context of half-flats or twisted tori, but this more general set of things which comes in with the Q's and R's is something we don't really have a complete understanding of at this time. Okay, so that's basically what I wanted to say. I'll say a few more things about further directions now really quickly and then conclude. The point up to this point right here is essentially that it seems like there are all these additional fluxes, and we better understand how to deal with them in string theory if we really want to be trying to consider the whole space of string vacua. So let me just very briefly mention 3 points of ongoing work, much of which has been happening due to conversations with people at this workshop. So one obvious way in which we want to generalize this is to mirror symmetry. Right? So there's this nice picture of mirror symmetry through Sturmendry-Yau-Zaslow, where we think of a Calabi-Yau as a T3 vibration over, say, an S3. And then the T3 vibration becomes singular. So Dave Morrison has been kindly helping me to learn all this stuff. But you have this T3 vibration. You have edges where you have one-dimensional lines where this thing becomes singular, which actually perhaps Dave can elaborate on a bit further. But this is the general structure here. And what we can now do is we can do T-duality everywhere except over this graph, and we have to somehow fill in the T-duality on the graph itself. And this is something which was done in the case of the Fs in the paper I mentioned by Guerrieri, Miku, Louis, and Waldrum, and then carried further in a nice paper by Tomasiello, who was here a couple weeks ago, where he showed that basically the T-dual, when you do the T-dual of an H with one leg on this S3, you come over here, you get a new class of monodromes. These monodromes are essentially twisted tori, and there's a topological way of filling this in to give a well-defined manifold, at least over the one-dimensional edges, so that this will give you at least a topological construction of the half-flat manifold, which is the mirror. Of course, we don't have a complete understanding of the space of half-flat manifolds, and that's still something which people can say a lot more about, but it seems pretty clear that this story is going to work out very well for the S. What we now want to do is do a similar thing for the Qs. I can't quite imagine how to do it for the Rs yet, but for the Qs, one could imagine doing this. Now we have a non-geometric monodromy as we go around here, and there is some stringy sense in which we can fill in the disk so that the boundary is the monodromy, and the string physics is still well-defined, giving us a smooth object which is ostensibly not a geometric thing, but which somehow might make sense in string theory. That's one thing. Another way we can extend this is by going beyond T-duality to U-duality. All the same sorts of things that I talked about here for T-duality may also be true if we include S-duality, and this leads one to speculate that there may be yet another set of fluxes. This is something Jesse and I have been working out more recently, but it seems that there actually need to be more fluxes to complete the U-duality story, and that these new non-geometric fluxes are essentially Ramon-Ramon rather than NSNS non-geometric fluxes. So I think there's a very similar story there, details to be worked out. And then, of course, there's the problem of finding solutions. This is something else we've been working on. We have some solutions, but the problem is to find, first of all, to have a better, more general sense of the set of solutions, and second of all, to find solutions which are explicitly under control and yet which have no geometric dual. So if we could find solutions which are as well-behaved as the 2A solutions, which DeWolf and Kotru and Giribetz and I found earlier this year, but which do not have, in any known T-duality frame, a geometric representation, I think that will be a very strong piece of evidence that we need to worry about these things when considering the space of string vacua. And I'll stop there. Sure. Yes.
You wanted to see that you got the appropriate duality. Of course, you eventually talked about non-commutative tori.
I didn't talk about non-commutative tori. I do not understand how to match the picture I talked about with Matai's nice picture of non-commutative tori. But they are things which presumably have an equivalent mathematical description in terms of non-commutative tori. I mean, Matai and I and Jesse and people have been speaking some, and I don't see any contradiction between these pictures.
Get that straight.
Yeah. Okay. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay.
Why not give up Calabi-Yaus? Has anyone tried to do non-commutative Calabi-Yaus? That's what's happening in the extra six dimensions. a lot of things you've said, you could imitate very quickly in the mountain community channel. So could anybody expand the universe by allowing your extra six dimensions with certain conditions so you have supersymmetry? And consider the analog for your
I don't know of anyone having done that explicitly. I mean, the natural context of that would be in is the K-theory context, where you look at the K-theory of the non-commutative Calabi. I don't know if Greg knows anything about people doing that. I mean, it is very suggestive that at least for these Q-type objects, there may be some sense in which these are non-commutative six-dimensional spaces.
That's why I bring it up.
It's quite possible.
You're forced into this only for the torus on your side, which is something complicated.
Oh, no, it'll happen for any Calabi.
Yeah, but it won't be.
If you start with a, but the point is that the mirror, if you take a Calabi Yau with general H flux, this is addressing the question of what is the mirror of that object, and so you can start in the realm where you just have a well-defined Calabi Yau with a given H flux, and then ask what is the class of objects you get as the duals. It seems like on the one hand you get these half flat manifolds, which are these guys. You definitely get something with Qs, which may be thought of as locally geometric, globally non-geometric, may be thought of in some sense as a non-commutative Calabi Yau. If that's the way you want to think about it, the non-commutative Calabi Yau, then you have to show how you can complete the mirror symmetry by essentially filling in the disk in some appropriate manner. I mean, I don't know how to talk about Sturm-Ogier Yau-Zaslow if the whole six dimensions is non-commutative.
You draw that picture, that connection, non-commutative connection, the whole non-commutative
Yau.
There are little bits and pieces of what you say.
Yeah. I'd love to explore that further. Yeah. I would love to. It is not at all inconceivable that somehow what is going on here is generally non-commutative Calabi Yaus as your compactification spaces.
What's the work about 4 years ago by Berenstein and Lee and another collaborator? Trying to analyze compactification on non-commutative Calabi Yaus. I don't really remember.
I think there are a lot of things you could mean by the term non-commutative Calabi Yau by the
answer. Really?
So I've been supposed to come here next week.
I have a question. If you turn on the Q's and the R's,
yes.
I guess that means there's no M theory left.
I am not sure about that. What makes you say that?
M theory left to be geometrical.
No, not necessarily. There could be non-geometrical.
What is a non-geometrical?
Well, you know, there's this T-duality in M theory, where you take M theory and compact it by on T3.
Yeah.
Right, and you invert the size of that T3. Imagine a T3 vibration over a circle where you do one of those as you go around. That could give you a non-geometric compactification down here.
Well,
and I think some of those will actually be related to some of these things. The other colleagues jump in. I'm happy to talk more about that.
But
I haven't thought much about it. But
I'd like to say a comment about the comments made after my suggestion. Usually when physicists mean non-commutative, it's especially here where you've got a symplectic two-form on the Calabi Yau, you really mean star product. And when I'm talking about non-commutative, I really mean an operator algebra of which star product is just a reflection of full symbol. And I think you really want the whole object, not just the star product that people more or less work with when they talk about the use of non-commutative theory in field theory.
Well, I mean, in some ways it would be very appealing. I mean, yeah, if I could just be philosophical. I mean, part of the reason why I think this is all very interesting is because we're really stuck in string theory in the geometrical language. And yet we all believe that somehow geometry is arising from some more fundamental building blocks, and we don't know what the tools are to talk about that. And it may be that if this is a case where we have a hard time describing it in terms of our conventional world sheet descriptions without moving beyond our conventional ideas of space-time, it may help us. So, I mean, string field theory, for instance, is a place where you have these algebras with star products and things like that, which are more general than just commutative space-time. And as you know, non-commutative space-time can emerge out of that. So I think I agree with you, and I think if this, that this has some chance of leading us towards a hint as to what the actual algebraic structure underlying string theory of transcendent geometry might be, and so that would be great. So until I can talk to anybody about it, I can't really do that.
Yeah, so you mentioned in these, at the Q level, given space-time, but that kind of non-commutative flux, of course, you can get a D-brain here a cycle and it changes character.
Yes.
I assume the same thing happens in, with appropriate fundamental strains as well? If they turn into momentum or...
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So can I think of that as being at the root of the problem trying to find a world sheet description of this process?
Absolutely. In fact, that's part of the problem. That's absolutely right.
Strings are not well-defined objects, some of these.
Yeah, I mean, there may be some way to think about the string background, but it has to be more subtle than what we're used to. Because something funny has to happen when the string wraps around in the z direction.
Does that mean that we're also...
That by itself is not... That's just an asymmetric girl with
Or in general, an asymmetric model. I mean, some of these things, you might expect that some of these things might be associated with asymmetric orbitals. These particular
ones. Have you actually shown any of them are asymmetric orbitals? I mean, those are.
Not these. No, these in fact can't be because there's no fixed point.
Obviously not.
These can't be because these are not asymmetric orbitals because there's no fixed point. But that does not rule out an asymmetric world sheet model, which maybe is a more general version of what Joe was saying.
It's even worse here, though, because the dilaton is general fixed at a non-zero value. So these don't have a perturbative description at all. Right. And when you have F and H flux both, you don't have the freedom to vary the
dilaton. Wait, Joe, why is the dilaton fixed? Only when you minimize.
I mean, you might find a solution with the dilaton where the string coupling is
smaller. According to his rules, it's with the dilaton.
You say you think of a bigger framework, right? You take the dilaton to be small, and then there's some.
Well, there might be a solution where the dilaton is small.
Okay.
I mean, for instance, if you take the two-way vacuum we know about, where the dilaton is small, and you just do t-duality. There's a 2B description of those things, and the 2B description includes the Qs. So I believe that those vacua should be describable in terms of some world sheet description on some spacetime with the Qs, and if you really understood what you were doing, you would see a miracle happening where somehow all the extra physics would decouple, and this would be a good approximation even in the 2B language. Right, so that's kind of the essence of why I think it's important to understand these things, is there are cases where miracles happen in, say, the 2B picture with the Qs turned on, and you have a solution which is totally under control with small string coupling. And we don't know, I mean, we have to understand what the principles are underlying that miracle in the cases we understand with the geometric T-dual to be able to rule out the possibility that there's other cases where it happens and we don't have a geometrical T-dual. Yeah?
Do you expect the domain walls between region with geometrical fluxes and non-geometrical fluxes?
Yes, I don't know how to describe them though. Mm-hmm. Yes, but I would expect such things.
But the domain walls should be the sources for these
Absolutely. Absolutely. There should be something which is a source for these non-geometric fluxes. I don't quite understand what they are, but...
Yeah, let's thank Ronnie for a very simple...